Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. One week from tomorrow, Tuesday, October 31st, many people will celebrate the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther, a German professor of theology, a composer, priest, monk, and a seminal figure in the Protestant Reformation, when he issued his 95 theses and, it is widely thought, nailed them to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. To commemorate this event, we'll hear talks by two Luther scholars, one this week, and the other next Monday, October 30th. This week's speaker will be Dean Bell, Provost, Vice President, and Professor of History at Spertus Institute for Jewish Learning and Leadership in Chicago, as well as a scholar of medieval and early modern Jewish history, especially in Germany. The overall title of the two programs is Luther and the Jews, Responsibility and Reconciliation. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday afternoon, June 25th, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Ronald Simpkins, the director of the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society at Creighton University.
Our first speaker is going to be Professor Dean Bell, who is the Provost, Vice President, and Professor of History at Spertus Institute for Jewish Learning and Leadership. In addition to being a leading voice for the advancement of Jewish higher education, he's also a scholar of medieval and early modern Jewish history, especially in Germany. And just to listen to the three books that he's written, you kind of understand why we asked him to speak today. He's the author of Sacred Communities, Jewish and Christian Identities in 15th Century Germany, which is the period that's just about the time, the setting of the Reformation, Jews in Early Modern World, and Jewish Identity in Early Modern Germany. And so he comes well equipped to talk to us about Luther and his historical context. So, with that, please help me welcome Dean Bell.
Well, let me begin by thanking Ron and Leonard for the kind invitation and for everybody who's been involved in putting this event together. These are important conversations, and I'm glad to be a part of this, so thank you. And Peter, it's nice to meet you in person finally and continue the conversation. So let me begin on this 500th anniversary of the Reformation, or at least we think it's the 500th anniversary, some debate about whether or not Martin Luther ever nailed 95 theses to any doors, though we know that he did publish and circulate these theses around this time. But I begin with what I call the value and challenges of anniversaries. For those of you who are married and have anniversaries, you might struggle with this as well, but anniversaries give us an opportunity to reflect back over a period of time, but in a certain sense to ask very different kinds of questions than we may have experienced about the events when they unfolded. And so as we look back over time, I think we often superimpose questions, ideas that we have now on the past, and I think we do this particularly when it comes to Martin Luther and the Reformation. So I want to talk a little bit about the challenges of these anniversaries, but also the opportunities. It allows us to come to grips with difficult questions, and clearly some difficult questions will arise. I will give my initial dedication here at the beginning that you want to be careful about the language. Luther could be, rather poignant in his language, and I haven't shied away from some of that here, so I apologize. I don't intend to offend anybody's sensibilities, though Luther might have. And I think it adds to the richness of the conversation, so we'll spend a little bit of time on that. I'm going to spend the first part of the presentation talking about Martin Luther and his views on Jews and Judaism, and those are not the same things exactly. As you'll see as I go through this a little bit, Luther didn't really know Jews in any specific kind of personal way, with maybe a few exceptions. And for him, Judaism was a theological construct. And so the way he dealt with these two issues, although we've lumped them together, isn't exactly the same. Most people have argued that there were two Martin Luthers when it came to Jews and the Judaism. The early Luther, who was very friendly to Jews and was open to converting them to Christianity, and the later Luther, who had sort of thrown up his hands and decided that, in fact, Jews couldn't be converted, and rather they needed to be banished, or maybe worse. As I'm going to suggest to you, that is not the line that I take. I actually think Luther is quite consistent in his theology and his approach to both Jews and Judaism, though I would certainly confess that his language does get a little bit more volatile and violent as he gets older, And that's true not only about the Jews and Judaism, it's about everything that Luther writes, already beginning in the 1530s. So we'll start with Luther. And I'll talk a little bit about some of these concerns that I think occupied Luther's attention for much of his career, not just at the beginning and not just at the end. I want to suggest that there are a lot of different issues involved with Luther's treatment of Jews and Judaism. And in fact, it allows us to look at many broader theological concerns, as well as contemporary political and social and cultural issues as well. So although Luther wrote quite a bit about Jews and Judaism, for him they really reflected many other conversation and theological points that we should consider. Also, the other thing that I suppose is useful to say is that Luther didn't live in a vacuum. And although we are giving a lot of attention to Luther, in part because of this 500th anniversary, Luther was a person of his time, of his culture, and he certainly imbibed a lot of Christian conversation about Jews and Judaism and contributed to that dialogue and discussion as well. And then finally, I want to talk a little bit about the historical reception of Luther, both amongst his contemporary reformers, but also amongst later Jewish scholars as well, because as you have intuited already, there isn't a consistent line of interpretation. And in fact, many Jewish philosophers and theologians already in the 19th and 20th centuries were quite sympathetic to Luther and his theology, if not necessarily his work about Jews. So let's jump right in. You'll notice his dates, which is important, 1483 to 1546. For those of us who are historians, this is remarkable because it means I've got another almost 30 years of anniversaries coming up, because Luther wrote a lot of stuff, published something almost every year, was involved in something every year. I got a lot of work coming up in the years ahead. It's terrific. All right, so I begin with what I call the good Luther, and I understand, I wasn't sure what the setup would look like here. I'm certain that those of you in the distance are not going to be able to see this, so I'm going to read the quote and comment on it a little bit. This comes from Luther's very early work, where we sort of have a very positive impression about how Luther thought about the Jews. He writes, "Therefore I will cite from Scripture the reasons that move me to believe that Christ was a Jew, born of a virgin, that I might perhaps also win some Jews to the Christian faith." Now we get to that part that I warned you about. "Our fools, the popes, bishops, sophists, and monks, the crude asses' heads, have hitherto so treated the Jews that anyone who wished to be a good Christian would almost have had to become a Jew. If I had been a Jew and had seen such dolts and blockheads govern and teach the Christian faith, I would sooner have become a hog than a Christian. They have dealt with the Jews as if they were dogs rather than human beings. They have done little else than deride them and seize their property. When we are inclined to boast of our position, we should remember that we are but Gentiles, while the Jews are the lineage of Christ. We are aliens and in-laws. They are the blood relatives, cousins, and brothers of our Lord. Accordingly, I beg my dear papists, should they be growing weary of denouncing me as a heretic, to seize the opportunity of denouncing me as a Jew." This is from his early work in 1523, that Jesus Christ was born a Jew. By the way, they would seize that opportunity, and he was accused of Judaizing for the rest of his career. The interesting thing, of course, is that Luther accused Catholics of Judaizing, and the Protestants accused Lutherans of Judaizing. Judaizing apparently was a bad thing, and everybody did it, at least according to their opponents. And I want to point out here that this early kind of positive approach is positive in some ways, right? He's obviously critical of how medieval Christianity has treated the Jews. On the other hand, note that it is really conversionary in nature, right? It's not that Jews and Judaism in and of themselves are good, but how could we hope to convert them to the true faith at the end of the day if we treat them the way that we treat them? So positive, I suppose, if you're looking at it from a Christian perspective, those of us reading Jewish history, I can't really see this good Luther as being particularly good, or, by the way, particularly different from other writers about the same time, or even before him. Now, there are other parts of this early, quote-unquote, good Luther that I think are also telling, and you don't have to wait until his later writings to see some of his animosities begin to emerge. So he writes, for example, in his gloss to the Psalms, already in the middle of the teens, "God rejected the Jews altogether according to the flesh and killed the standing of the synagogue and put the law to death, in which they nevertheless think that they are living, but they are not alive before God. The fact that their sacrifices and ceremonies and works are dead, this God did with the word alone, for he removed them and determined that they should come to an end. But since they were unwilling, the wrath of indignation was sent upon them." So a little less positive, perhaps. Not entirely so. I mean, this is still based on some theological principles of the medieval period, which we'll talk about as well. But I want to suggest to you that, in fact, Luther had a variety of opinions about Jews and Judaism from the beginning until the very end, and they preoccupied a lot of his work. And I would suggest that even at the end, he begins to solidify some of the points that he made even early on in his theological perspective. But as you'll see, there are some sharpening politics. He has his own successes and his own challenges to grapple with. After all, Luther was himself a human being and faced many different kinds of contexts. There's a wonderful new biography by Lyndall Roper, which I recommend highly. It's very long, so you're going to need a long time to read it. But it tries to present the kind of, not a psychoanalytical analysis of Luther, that's been done before, but a kind of more nuanced picture of who Luther was as a human being, as well as who he was involved in his community and his society of the period in which he lived. But as we see, towards the end of his life, you can already begin to get a sense of the kind of growing difficulty that he's having with Jews of his day and Judaism. He writes in 1546, in about one of the last things that he publishes, "They daily blaspheme and slander our Lord Jesus Christ. Since they do this and we know about it, we should not tolerate it. For if I tolerate in my midst someone who slanders, blasphemes, and curses my Lord Jesus Christ, then I make myself a participant in the sins of another. But if I already have enough sins of my own, then you, Lord, should not tolerate them, but drive them away," that is, drive the Jews away. "If, however, they convert, give up usury, and receive Christ, then we will gladly regard them as our brothers." So again, the same basic message as we saw in some of his earlier works, but now in a political context in which he suggests that, in fact, if Jews don't convert, if they don't turn to Christianity, then you lords, that is, you secular leaders, have every right to chase them away. Now, part of this change in, not necessarily in the end goals, but in the way that he describes these things, is related to some of his political battles. And many of these are related to his interaction with the popes, but also with other more radical groups within the Reformation. And in many ways, Luther felt like he was battling two different fronts. The more zealous reformers, we might say, particularly in South Germany, in Zurich and other places, but also the papacy on the other hand. And so we already see in some of his language this kind of growing difficulty that he's having with a variety of different groups, and I would argue is not very specific to the Jews. In fact, he seems to superimpose it on just about everybody. Writing in the 1530s in his commentary on Genesis, he notes, "Moreover, through the worship of Baal, there was depicted a monstrous form of righteousness and superstitious piety, which prevails widely to this day. By means of this, the Jews, heretics, and monks," notice that that's an interesting group of people to lump together, "that is," what does he call them? "Arrogant individualists worship the true God according to their own idea with most ridiculous zeal. With their excessive piety, they are worse than the most ungodly. That is, for the sake of God, they are in fact the enemies of God." And he goes on, "We acknowledge, of course, that it is a great benefit that we have received the language, that is Hebrew, from the Jews, but we must beware of the dung of the rabbis, who have made of Holy Scripture a sort of privy in which they deposited their foulness and their exceedingly foolish opinions. I am advising this because even among our own theologians," and by the way, that would include some Lutherans as well, "many give too much credit to the rabbis in explaining the meaning of Scripture." So on the one hand, he's lumped together Jews, heretics, and monks as a sort of, an anti-Christ in a certain kind of way. And you'll see in a little while, he's got all sorts of visual images, and much of it is quite scatological. Someone asked me who my favorite Lutheran writer was, and it would have to be Luther. And then they said, "Who's your favorite early modern writer?" And I said, "It would have to be Luther." And they asked me who my favorite writer of all time is, and I think it would have to be Luther. Because you don't have to like his message, but it's really fun and exciting to read Luther. It loses something in translation sometimes, but not always. And but it's also something that's a little bit more sharply focused on Jews as he gets a little bit older as well, and particularly biblical interpretation, where he feels somehow that he's being attacked on many different fronts. And particularly the idea that the rabbis and their interpretations of Scripture should be taken seriously. Now, Luther himself does cite from time to time rabbinic authorities, though and sometimes in a disparaging kind of way. And it's clear that many of his contemporaries relied on rabbinic and Jewish commentaries as well. So Luther here is responding, I would say, to a variety of different pools throughout society, and a number of political and theological battles that he himself is fighting. But it is true, by the time that we get to the 1540s, particularly in three major works towards the end of his life, that Luther articulates very dramatic kind of anti-Jewish sensibilities. As you will hear, my sense of this is that they're not particularly anti-Jewish compared to anything else in the 16th century. And you can find similar kinds of diatribes amongst Catholics and Protestants, as well as Lutherans. But clearly, there's a small section on the Jews and their lies in 1543, which I think many people have focused on, in part because they were co-opted in contemporary history and modern history as well, to suggest that Luther, in fact, went over the deep edge, as it were. But I'd like to point out, just by way of context, that in the first place, Luther, even in his later works, wasn't really concerned with converting the Jews anymore. He assumed that was impossible. And that may, in fact, have undergirded some of the venom with which he was writing. The second thing I want to point out is that the audience for his later text is also a little bit unclear. It clearly wasn't a Jewish audience. What is likely is that he was thinking about the Christian princes, how he was going to engage with them in any kind of substantive kind of way, and he was offering a kind of political feedback and criticism as well. And I think this needs to be taken into account. Nevertheless, there are seven major points in this last piece of his in 1543 that deals with the Jews that everybody has cited, and I'm certain you've heard about before. Their synagogues should be burned or buried. Their houses should be razed and destroyed. Their idolatrous prayer books and Talmudic writings should be taken. Their rabbis should be forbidden from teaching. All privileges of safe conduct should be abolished. They should be prohibited from exacting usury, and their monetary possessions should be confiscated. And they should be forced to earn their keep by the sweat of their brow. Or, if there are good Christians who fear them, they should be completely driven away. And these are, in a very short period of time, the things that have become most memorable about Luther and Luther's position on the Jews. I want to point out that this is about two or three pages in a very long book on the Jews and their lies, and only one of a very large number of pieces that Luther wrote over many, many years. Now, that doesn't exonerate him from saying these things or having them co-opted later on in history. On the other hand, this was of a specific time, of a specific context, and directed at Christian princes. And one could almost read underneath this the sense that Christian princes have an obligation to make certain that the lands they rule over are religiously intact and pure, and Jews, or by the way, anybody else who causes them to stray, should somehow be punished or somehow be expelled from the area. And in fact, we have lots of battles between Catholics and Protestants and Lutherans throughout much of this period, never mind the more radical groups as well. So again, I don't want to suggest that this is somehow acceptable. On the other hand, it does kind of stem from a lot of the earlier discussions that he's had. And in terms of the practical implications of it, we also, as I'm going to suggest, don't really have much evidence that too many people acted on this. There were a couple incidents where there was anti-Jewish animus, some opportunities for expulsion of Jewish communities as a result of the publication of this. And in fact, we know the Jewish community went out of its way to make sure that this volume was suppressed for a number of years. So although it was printed, it was kept out of circulation in parts of the Holy Roman Empire for a while. So I think people recognize the problematic nature of some of this. On the other hand, as I suggest, it's part of a much larger consideration. Now, we don't have a lot of Jewish responses around that time that address it, but there is one famous one, and it's a fellow named Yossel of Rosheim, who was a sort of shtadlan, a kind of intercessionary between the Jewish community and the secular regime. And Yossel wrote lots of things in Hebrew, some memoirs, some chronicles, even some halachic, some legal discussions as well, though he wasn't really recognized as a rabbinic figure. And he writes the following, and there's really some meaty stuff in here as well. And it gives you a sense, by the way, that Luther wasn't only writing about Jews and Judaism, but Jews were writing about Luther and Christianity as well, which is an important point for us to come back to. He also writes, "At all times, as we have now seen with our own eyes in the case of a people that has established a new faith." Now, keep in mind, he's writing to the Catholic audience, to the emperor in particular, and so he's going to denigrate the Lutherans as a new faith, as an innovation, with all kinds of leniencies in order to cast off the yoke. That is, these sort of liberal Lutherans who are trying to break from tradition and ritual. And their aim was to set upon us, the Jews, and annihilate the people of Israel by various and harsh legal measures and massacres. hard-pressed to find a whole lot of massacres in this context, though we do know that there were a few physical altercations where Jews were attacked. But God, seeing the affliction of his people, sent his angel, merciful kings, to give power and might to his majesty, the Emperor Charles, note the political tone here, long may he live, that he might prevail over them on many occasions, breaking their covenant and voiding their conspiracy. Now, note the language here. I mean, Yussel is really making a concerted effort to demonize Luther and his followers. And by a miracle, he triumphed and saved the people of Israel from the hands of the new faith established by the priest called Martin Luther, an unclean man. And this is a play on the Hebrew lo tahor, which means impure, lo tahor Luther. Sounds similar, right? So it's beautiful in Hebrew when you read this. Who intended to destroy and slay all the Jews, both young and old. Blessed be the Lord who foiled his counsel and frustrated his designs and allowed us to behold his vengeance and many salvations to this day. So you get a sense here that this is an active kind of Jewish response to Luther and his writings, and it did have some success, particularly as the Catholic emperor was interested in suppressing the Lutheran movement itself. So this in long, story is Luther in a context. Early writings, later writings, some continuities throughout, but a kind of a sharpening language and vocabulary as he gets older, some of it having to do with throwing up his hands and assuming that he can't convert the Jews, but most of it really related to other political and theological battles, and the same kind of language. By the way, the Pope doesn't fare a whole lot better than Jews in any of Luther's writing. In fact, sometimes it's even worse. So I think one has to put that in an important context as well. Well, in order to back this out a little bit, the little bit of time I have, I want to sort of share some contextual issues with you. And I want to look very quickly at a kind of late medieval context, because after all, Luther wasn't coming up with all this stuff on his own. Those of you who are Lutheran scholars will forgive me, but I actually think there's not that much that's new in Luther. Luther brings together some remarkable late medieval scholastic and theological ideas, but he does it in a really impressive and, I think, novel kind of way. But I wouldn't say that Luther was always so innovative. In fact, oftentimes was quite changeable in his theological positions as he grappled with contemporary political issues. But we want to look a little bit at the late medieval context, a little bit at the idea of daily life, because at the end of the day, what did Jews really mean for Luther? He encountered very few human beings, but he certainly had a construct of what Jews meant, and I think that's worth unpacking very briefly. I want to say something quickly about this geopolitical context. I think it's worth putting Luther in a comparative perspective. There are other writers around the same time who are equally famous. You might have heard of Erasmus of Rotterdam, the great humanist. He doesn't have such nice things to say about Jews either. Even Johannes Reuchlin, who's the great defender of the Talmud from being burned, I wouldn't call him a philo-Semite by any stretch of the imagination. So it is an interesting kind of comparative perspective. This is also the great age of books, print, and polemic, as well as ethnography. And the way that Luther thinks about and depicts Jews and Judaism needs to be understood in that context. And then finally, I want to point out that, in fact, the beginning of the 16th century is what we like to call an age of anxiety. With apocalyptic fervor burning, with false messiahs running through the Jewish and Christian communities, and as well as Muslim communities as well. This is a very complicated age, and we need to understand that if we're going to make any sense of Luther. So let me jump into each of these, which I'm not going to spend much time on, but I think is worth putting in some context. So let me just say something quickly about the Jews living in Germany, and that is, there weren't that many of them. There were only about 25,000 Jews living in all of Germany. Probably about 0.02% of the population at any given point, but they were scattered over more than 1,000 different areas. So when we think about a Jewish community in this period, there were a few that had about 500 Jews living in them. There were some that had between 100 and 200, even a few that might have had around 40, but the vast majority of these places had about 10 Jews living in them. So we're talking about settlements, not communities. And so it's not surprising that Luther didn't really have a whole lot of interaction with these people. There were Jews who lived in the areas and where Luther circulated and even where he was born, but these weren't large Jewish population centers by any stretch of the imagination. And so we need to take that into account when we begin to think about how Luther thought about the Jews and how he interacted with them. The second piece is a kind of late medieval theological context. And that is, although in the high Middle Ages, say the 12th and 13th centuries, there was a lot of discussion about ritual within the Catholic Church, by the time we get to the later Middle Ages, there's increasing laicization. That is, lay people are involved in more and more aspects of religion. And there is what I like to call a shift to moralism and legalism. And why this is important is that I think it makes Jews a different kind of target. On the one hand, Jewish rituals have been swept aside. That's not important anymore as the new covenant takes over from the old. On the other hand, when we create a moralistic society and Jews are outside of that, all of a sudden everything they do and their very existence is threatening to society. So this late medieval shift to what I call moralism in particular becomes radical when we think about the Jews. And just give you one quote from a famous preacher of the period, Bernard of Siena, who's wandering about northern Italy and parts of southern Germany. "And if between these two things, either to hear Mass or hear a sermon, you can only do one, you must miss Mass rather than the sermon. The reason for this is that there is less danger to your soul in not hearing Mass than there is in not hearing the sermon." Don't tell that to my rabbi. "Tell me, how would you believe in the Blessed Sacrament on the altar if it weren't for the sacred preaching which you heard? Your faith in the Mass comes to you only through preaching. Also, what would you know about sin if it weren't for preaching? How would you know about any good act and how you must go about it if you didn't learn it through sermons?" So part of this kind of moralistic culture of the later Middle Ages, but also one that's heavily emphasized on the spoken word and on preaching in particular. Now, the way that we think about the Jews throughout the Middle Ages was kind of complicated, and it goes in a certain sense back all the way to St. Augustine, who created a doctrine that we like to refer to as the doctrine of the witness. Basically, on the one hand, Jews are to be punished for persecuting and killing Jesus. On the other hand, they were the chosen people, and we need a remnant of Israel to survive for the second coming to come to fruition. So there's a sort of tension between persecution on the one hand and a certain amount of toleration in maintaining a Jewish presence throughout the world in order to usher in the second coming. And so we have this kind of sense that undergirds a lot of medieval Christian thinking about the Jews. This is nicely demonstrated in what we find as this kind of parallel motif of the church and the synagogue. The church usually described or conceptualized as being young and vibrant and seeing, whereas the synagogue is dressed as an old woman who's blindfolded and can't really see very far, has been replaced by the sort of newer ideas and newer religious orientations. So a kind of long-standing medieval motif about Judaism as being superseded by Christianity, the old dispensation being superseded by a new one. And this certainly dictates how Luther thinks about the Jews. He is very much a Christian in terms of his orientation, and he sees Judaism as a kind of oppositional straw man against his own Christian religion, and he uses that way very effectively. There are, of course, other kinds of more folksy images of Jews that also begin to emerge by the time we get to the later Middle Ages. This is a famous one, the Judensau, where we have Jews doing unspeakable acts, with defecation of the sow and suckling at the bottom. All this to suggest not only that there's something inhuman about the Jews, but also that they're hypocritical, right? Jews want nothing to do with pigs, and yet look what they're almost worshiping this pig here. I should point out that there's a very famous image that comes out of Lutheran circles in the early 16th century of the Pope riding on a pig as well, holding a pile of excrement, which is supposed to be papal decrees. And so again, there's this interesting connection between the iconography of Jews and Catholics, at least in Lutheran and Protestant lands in this period. Or as we get further into the end of the Middle Ages in the 15th century, you can't make them out, but these are host desecration and ritual murder accusations, almost like comic strips, if you will, right? But if you look at these, the sort of dastardly deeds of Jews who are separate from society, who are doing all sorts of criminal, mischievous things in the dark behind their own walls. Early on, Luther seemed to reject these ideas. He didn't make much of this, in part because, you know, this came out of Catholic late medieval Europe. But later on, as Luther began to read other accounts and changed in his own perspectives, he seems to have embraced these ideas a little bit more. He seemed to suspect that maybe Jews were doing untoward kinds of things. In terms of daily life experience, Luther has a real problem because he doesn't really know what Jews are. And in fact, we don't really know what Jews are. How do we define Jews in this period? Okay. Jews could, in fact, be individuals who were involved in some sort of Jewish law. That is, halakhically speaking, they were Jews. But they could also be abstract or theological Jews. They could serve a particular purpose for Christian theologians or for others. And then we have this wonderful problem of Maranos or Conversos or hybrid identities in the early modern period. And Luther oftentimes is responding to this. He feels that one of the dangers of Judaism is that it's infiltrating Christianity. and he speaks particularly of some of the fringe movements in Christianity in Bohemia and Moravia, who he thinks are trying to convert people to a form of Judaism. So he's got all of these sort of strange ideas of Jews and Judaism that are circulating throughout, and part of the problem I think that he has is he doesn't know what to do with them, or he doesn't know consistently what it means when he's talking about Jews and Judaism. He comes up with his own methods and his own definitions, but these are really quite complicated. In terms of political context, there were a lot of different discussions about what to do with the Jews. And even before Luther wrote his most anti-Jewish treatises, there was a discussion in the Duchy of Hesse about whether or not the Jews should be expelled. The Landgrave Philip of Hesse, who's right in the middle here, decided to ask for some theological feedback. Martin Bucer, who was one of the South German reformers of the period, not always a great fan of Luther, decided that, in fact, the Jews should be expelled because they bring sort of dysfunction to a society, and actually, as a precursor to Luther, suggests that it's the local lord who has the responsibility to make sure that people like Jews don't live in this area if they're somehow causing some sort of religious problem within the community. At the end of the day, however, the Landgrave decides that the Jews stem from the chosen people. They might again be the chosen people. And in the meantime, they're pretty good for business. So we're going to go ahead and keep them for a little while in any event. So I bring that as a kind of interesting comparison. Before Luther, this discussion is clearly going on. And I should point out that almost every expulsion of Jewish communities that we know about happened in the late 15th century, before Luther's writing his anti-Jewish works. So there are a couple cases where there's some connection, but it doesn't seem to be so significant. Other figures, and I'm not going to read these, but Erasmus of Rotterdam had very, very few good things to say about Jews, and oftentimes had very few things to say that were positive about Jewish writings. Talmudic writings, the Hebrew language, or anything else. Johannes Reuschen, I mentioned before, who was a great protector of Jewish books, also didn't particularly care for the Jews as human beings or as a society. In fact, sort of assumed that by the instruction of Christians in the Hebrew language, we could get rid of even having to have Jews as Hebrew teachers, which seemed to be one of their main functions in society. So even the positive kinds of folks who were writing, in less kind of vivid language than Luther was, weren't necessarily very positive about Jews and Judaism. Other reformers like Philip Melanchthon, who was Luther's secondhand man, or Huldrych Zwingli, who was a kind of lifelong adversary, weren't always negative about Jews. They didn't believe ritual murder accusations. They saw some value in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, and the covenantal relationship. But they were equally anti-Jewish in terms of whether or not Jews should be tolerated in society, and their writings are peppered with anti-Jewish language, not so dissimilar in some ways from Luther. The battle of books and the sort of iconographic discussions that I mentioned before we see throughout, and as I suggested, it's not only Jews who are presented in a negative light, but a variety of other groups as well. Now, Luther based a lot of his later comments about the Jews, and some have suggested that his increasing negative attitude is related to certain kinds of writings, most notably Antonius Margarita's The Entire Jewish Faith. This purports to be a kind of memoir, if you will, or instruction book by somebody who converted from Judaism to Christianity and was going to uncover all of the anti-Christian elements in Jewish society. And in fact, Margarita is not accurate about a lot of things, but he does point to some aspects of Jewish culture that are insular and that are, in a certain sense, anti-Christian. And so this book, by the way, the same Yossel of Rosheim tried to get this book, kept this book from circulating throughout the empire as well. But it's clear that Luther read this and he refers to it frequently. And we believe that it colored some of his views of Jews and Judaism throughout this period. So Margarita, for example, goes on to talk about how some prayers in the liturgy in the synagogue are actually quite anti-Christian, or they refer obliquely to Christians in a negative way. I have to say there's some truth to this. Even more, I think, for Luther is that there's a famous book called Toldot Sefer Yeshu, which is the sort of generations of the book of a book of the generations of Jesus. And this is a very anti-Christian polemical book. And every time that Christians would come to the Jewish community and ask about it, they'd say, oh, no, we never heard of it. Well, as it turns out, we have hundreds of handwritten manuscripts, which means it was probably the most popular book circulating in the Jewish community. And it's quite negative about the figure of Jesus and Mary and early Christians. And so that, combined with this Antonius Margarita text, I think does inform Luther's increasing and negative position on Jews. Now, This was an age of anxiety, as I mentioned before, and all of these things come together: warfare, pestilence, corruption, social acceleration, and apocalyptic tendencies that I think force Luther's hand even further. As he tries to see the world around him as it's unfolding, Luther becomes more concerned about many specific issues. And there's a famous, I once did a quick search and I came across 30 different false messiahs in the Jewish community in Germany in the course of the early 16th century. Similar kinds of figures running around in Christian society. They're often deemed heretics, but we have similar kind of representation in the Jewish community as well, suggesting this is a period of heightened tension, more generally speaking. Now, there were a lot of negative responses even amongst Christian scholars to Luther's anti-Jewish writings. Andreas Osiander, who was a dutiful Lutheran in Nuremberg, is famous for sending an apology to some Jewish scholars. He was somehow felt really bad about the kind of language and the things that Luther was saying. Urbanus Regius was trying to argue for toleration in the city of Braunschweig, even as that city was trying to expel the Jews based on Luther's writings. So even here we have a kind of reformer who sees a more positive opportunity for Jewish-Christian relations, again within a conversionary context. Heinrich Bullinger is said to have complained of Luther's lewd and houndish eloquence and his scurrility, which is appropriate for no one and still less for an old theologian. And Martin Bucer, we met before, noticed that one of Luther's late anti-Jewish works was piggish and murky and could not be defended even if written by a swineherd. Now, you can see there that not everybody agreed with Luther on a lot of different things. But what I would point out is that even his critics were fundamentally after conversion of Jews and themselves were fairly anti-Jewish in their orientation, and that Luther's writings could be co-opted to justify different anti-Jewish activities, but clearly these activities had been taking place long before Luther was writing. So we can't really blame Luther for all of those. In the last couple minutes, I simply want to suggest that Luther's anti-Jewish writings garnered some positive response even amongst Jews and even in the contemporary period. Heinrich Heine, for example, thought that Luther was the bastion of Geistfreiheit, of spiritual freedom. Hermann Cohen compared Luther with Moses, not a bad company to hold. Franz Rosenzweig, a philosopher who I confess I've never understood, showed a great deal of respect for Luther because of his biblical translation and his prowess with language, which I would have to agree. Although, you know, as I read a lot of Luther, I don't think his Hebrew was quite as good as he thought it was. And many have suggested that, in fact, there is a Sonderweg, a special way that led from Luther's thinking and writing about the Jews to the catastrophe of the Holocaust in the 20th century. And I'm briefly just going to mention the pros and cons. Some have asserted that Luther's Jewish writings had an enduring, largely negative influence, and we often say from Luther to Hitler, right? That Luther was a father of modern anti-Semitism, which, by the way, is anachronistic and makes no sense. We can't speak of anti-Semitism in the 16th century. We didn't have those kinds of biological definitions or racial definitions. We can't speak of anti-Judaism, and there I think we're on firmer ground. But many see this kind of historical link between Luther and the Nazis. And by the way, the Nazis, in fact, did oftentimes co-opt Lutheran writing in the same way that they co-opted a variety of other medieval writings and images and discussions and illustrations. But some have suggested that we can't really do this. On the Jews and Their Lies, that most venomous of his later works, didn't really have much of an impact, was not as successful as his early, friendlier work. The argument has been that his later anti-Jewish works were very rarely, if ever, reprinted. But there's some ways of thinking about this. It's true that these later works didn't get reprinted in whole, but they did appear in many different kinds of writings over the centuries. And whether or not they were read in a negative way, or he intended them to be read in a negative way, they were utilized for a variety of purposes. And so I think we need to think a little bit about how something that you write today can be co-opted down the road and what kind of role that you might have in that. Do we have any kind of responsibility for things that we write today that might be used in a negative way down the road? And we know that the Nazis used a variety of anti-Jewish images that were drawn from this period, and there's many examples that we could give if we had a little bit more time. More than that, you know, there certainly were some overt connections amongst Nazi writers about how Kristallnacht, for example, was associated with an anniversary of Luther's writings. Or one German official, I found an interesting quote, who said that it should be realized that the wicked Nazis have simply carried out the instruction of Luther. The synagogues have been burnt just as the father of Protestantism required. So going back to that sort of late quote that we saw. On the other hand, we had some interesting and compelling examples of pastors who fought against anti-Semitism and anti-Christian folkish tendencies that emerged before and during the Second World War. We have people who spoke out and were opposed to church participation. On the other hand, we had some who disavowed the sort of radical Nazi version of anti-Semitism without necessarily disavowing an anti-Jewish perspective. And so there's an interesting balance that I'm sure Peter will say a little bit about for us as well. So just to wrap up here, it's important to consider not only what Luther himself wrote, but the late medieval in context in which he was situated. Luther was multifaceted and changeable. He's one of the most complex individuals I've ever met at a distance. I was at a Center for Creative Leadership program recently, and they asked me to identify the person who I thought epitomized leadership. And I'm certain they expected me to come up with some Jewish figure, walking around with my kippah as I was. And I said, Luther. And the woman, she nearly choked. But I described a number of the qualities of Luther when we think about leadership in terms of communication and creating a narrative and really fathering a movement. He was a sort of impressive leader in a lot of ways. So more about that informally. The absence of real Jews. So much of the discussion here is about a concept, about a theory. It's not about real people necessarily, but we see that it could potentially have impact on real human beings. And so what is our responsibility as we're engaging in theological conversation to think about not only ideas, but people as well? The centrality of Judaism in the Hebrew Bible. It's been argued recently that the center of the Enlightenment was Judaism in the Hebrew Bible, which strikes some of us as a little peculiar, but if you look at the amount of writing about these topics, it's enormous, even more so with the Reformation. I would say in some ways the Reformation was a reformation of the Hebrew Bible, different interpretation and approach to it, but really at the forefront of many discussions. The value of Jews and Judaism as an oppositional force, as a way of creating identity within the Lutheran or in some cases the Catholic or the Reformed churches as well. The role of politics and theology. I know it's difficult these days to think about how we separate those out, but we really can't separate those out. The two of them, particularly in the 16th century, go hand in glove in a way that we don't always remember. And then finally, the question that I'm sure we'll circle back to, which is the dangers and obligations of looking back in these anniversaries, but also looking ahead, and how we ascribe responsibility to people in the past. Right, we're asking questions today about some very significant issues and how we think about Jewish and Christian dialogue. What's fair to hold people accountable for and what's not? And with that, I will conclude, hopefully with a lot of questions for conversation. Thank you.
Well, I just had, you talked a little bit about Abraham's faith, and could either of you answer how the rabbis responded to his ideas of faith through salvation, or did they respond at all? How did that impact rabbinic Judaism at all?
How we define these different groups in the first place is problematic. So, you know, it's true of Luther, but I think it's certainly true in the opening centuries of the Common Era. We need to make distinctions between different groups of rabbinic Jews, of different sectarian groups, of ancient Israelites, of early Christians. I'm not sure we're actually talking about all of the same people in any of it. So there certainly were some who would have responded in a kind of favorable way to this idea of faith, versus works or law or whatever it might be, and others who would have rejected it out of hand. We don't really, in terms of responses to Luther, who is co-opting Paul and other medieval Christian writers, I can't think of any off the top of my head of Jewish respondents to Luther who would have argued him on that point. Jewish responses to Luther weren't generally about theological fine points. They were about political implications, protection from expulsion, the language that he uses and the like. So it's very rare, at least in the 16th and 17th centuries. We might, and I'm not a student of modern Jewish theology, but I mean, we might certainly have some of those in the 19th or the early 20th century, where in fact we are dealing with questions of faith and law and sort of secularism and other things that are arising. But as far as I know, there isn't a lot of discussion about those issues, at least within the Jewish community. Now, having said that, there are certainly some conversations in rabbinic response already in the 15th century about what it is that makes somebody Jewish. And there's a famous dictate that a Jew who sins is still a Jew. So in a certain sense, it's not about our actions per se. We are defined as Jewish based, in a certain sense, either on our faith or on our genealogy or lineage or whatever it might be. And Luther certainly discusses that issue as well, because he's critical of the idea of lineage, because it sort of comes up against faith. Faith is more important than lineage in his estimation, when he's being Pauline, I think. So there are some indirect conversations around that, but I'm not aware of any Jewish discussions, at least in Germany in this period, that grapple with that issue. Yeah.
It better be a good one then. it occurs to me, as I'm sitting here today, that in another, well, be it 300 years or perhaps 500 years, there might be a different discussion about who can be reconciled and how. It occurs to me that the Muslims were on the periphery of our discussion today. They were literally at the doorstep of Vienna in 1529. You reminded us of the Crusades. You wondered what we should call that land in the Middle East and chose not to pick a name. My questions are two. One is, to what extent did Luther respond to the Muslim world, and did that affect in any way his thinking about Jews? And the second question would be, are any of the things that you've learned over the last 30 years or so in thinking about reconciliation and reformulation of theology applicable to or helpful in our looking forward to the reconciliation that we might hope would occur sooner than 500 years from now?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Over the last 10 years or so, there has been some scholarship on Luther and Luther's views of the Muslims. And as you suggest, this is a significant topic given the relationship between the Ottoman Empire and Europe. Luther himself puts this in a kind of apocalyptic perspective, at the same time that he takes a kind of scholarly approach. And he has he's in favor of translating the Quran. He even comments upon some of this as well. And he does go through some similar kind of changes vis-a-vis Islam as he does with Judaism. His language seems to sharpen towards the end, not surprisingly, as they're knocking on the gates in Vienna. But it's not only related to that. But that's sort of emerging right now, I think, as a newer topic for conversation. The other thing that could be added to it is there's a good deal of ethnographic literature being written in the 16th century as well. So all of a sudden, Europeans and Germans in particular become interested in Jewish practices and rites and rituals, and the same is true of Muslims and certainly of Ottomans. This, I think, is further impacted by the fact that we have ambassadors going back and forth between the Holy Roman Empire and the Ottoman Empire, but it's a topic that's receiving a good deal of attention right now, I suppose in part because of contemporary political and global issues. But Luther, I think, does take a stand on this. I haven't studied him very specifically in this regard. There's an article that just came out literally about 6 months ago by Thomas Kaufmann in Tübingen, who is probably the leading, you would know better than I, but I think the leading authority on Luther, at least Luther's writings. And Kaufmann has only been interested in the last few years on Luther's Jewish writings, but he's now working on Luther's Muslim writings. And I think there's some interesting stuff in there that's going to emerge. So clearly an important topic, one that involves more than Luther and involves this political and religious issues, and one that has some sort of timely impact as well. But sort of in broad stroke, similar kinds of issues that Luther's grappling with Judaism, I think.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Dean Bell, Provost, Vice President, and Professor of History at Spertus Institute for Jewish Learning and Leadership in Chicago, as well as a scholar of medieval and early modern Jewish history, especially in Germany. 1 week from tomorrow, Tuesday, October 31st, many people will celebrate the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther, a German professor of theology, a composer, priest, monk, and a seminal figure in the Protestant Reformation, when he issued his 95 Theses and, it is widely thought, nailed them to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. To commemorate this event, we are presenting talks by two Luther scholars with the overall title of Luther and the Jews, Responsibility and Reconciliation. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday afternoon, June 25th, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Next week, we'll hear the second talk delivered by Peter Pettit, Associate Professor of Religion Studies and Director of the Institute for Jewish Christian Understanding at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.